Celebrating all things Bloomsbury Festival 2024. Very excited right now to be joined by a doctor in the house, Dr. Sharar Ali. How are you?
I'm well, Barra. Thanks very much for having me.
Pleasure. And thank you for being here. Really appreciate your time. Can we talk a bit about you before we get into the festival event and everything to look forward to? But you yourself, you're sort of your educational journey a little bit. We are in an educational establishment, Bloomsbury Institute. So, you know, there's a lot of students tuning in, and we'll probably want to hear your sort of educational journey and how you've kind of arrived, or when you arrived at being a doctor of many different disciplines, perhaps. But a bit of discussion around that.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I describe myself as a lifelong educationalist. So I both teach. Yeah. I'm very keen on lifelong learning, and that's part of the role of the London School of Philosophy. But I'm also a lifelong learner myself. And I started life as a biochemical engineer, actually, and quickly then encountered what I would now describe as ethical dilemmas. I was worried about technology pacing ahead, rushing ahead without proper public consent or ethical debate. And I realized that I had a passion for exploring questions quite deeply, which drew me to philosophy. And then I ended up studying philosophy, right up to PhD level. And I was particularly interested in applied ethics and moral philosophy, at the time also trying to settle questions around genetically modified food and organisms and whether the risks were outweighed by the benefits.
Yeah. Interesting. What do you think drew you to that? I mean, can you think back? I mean, this is not therapy. I'm not asking you to go back to your childhood too far, but
sure.
Like, was there parents into philosophy? Was there any kind of family stuff going on there? What drew you to those deeper questions, do you think?
Well, actually, when I had the idea to undertake a second first degree, I mean, this was the time when higher education wasn't quite as prohibitive as it is now in terms of fees. Mm. But it was still going to be a struggle. My father was not in favor of doing that. So I had to, you know, I was increasingly becoming independent anyway. But his idea was, you can do philosophy any time of your life. Go and have your career and maybe you can go return to philosophy later on in life. And I really knew at that point that, you know, when you have the philosophical bug, it's not something you can just park. And I'm glad I did that, because as with all the best of education, it affects how you view the world. Mm-hmm. It affects everything, potentially, about human identity and how you make decisions. So to have and to engage in deep philosophical questions, many of which aren't even resolved in terms of, for example, do we have free will? Mm-hmm. What happens when I die? Mm-hmm. What is the good life? These fundamental questions, which philosophers down the ages, going back to Socratic times, ancient Greeks, are unresolved and remain stirring.
As another example of somebody who's followed their passion in a way, I guess, you know, that, and perhaps a bit of rebellion in you as well against your dad telling you to go that way, and you said, no, I'm going to go this way. I get that as well. Oh, sorry, I'm projecting there, because I mean, I've talked about myself there being quite rebellious against my own dad and his kind of career path he had for me. So fascinating. So philosophy, it's such a broad subject, isn't it? I mean, but in relation to, you mentioned the food industry, mm-hmm. then. So what sort of, you know, how many years have you been really focused on that and the benefits of, like, food and how we should be looking at the science of food and philosophy?
Well, I was, as within the fold of an area that was becoming identifiable within philosophy, within moral and applied ethics, you know, I spent a couple of years on that. I worked in the European Parliament as well, actually, did a short stint there, working specifically on public policy. And that was around the time, you know, where we were still members of the EU.
Yeah.
Parliamentarians wanted to know a bit more. So I was working the Science and Technology Options Assessment Unit. Mm-hmm. And the idea was to bring applied ethics to bear upon real world environmental questions at the time.
Okay.
I mean, I still am engaged in environmentalism as a politician, as it happens. But the philosophy background, I think it helped me acquire not just, if you like, a robust sense of reality, but I think, you know, there can be a misnomer even now about what philosophy is. I think the Anglo-American tradition, which was the one that I was schooled in, is into argumentation.
Mm.
That doesn't mean with heat. It means an interest in persuasion, and not rhetoric either, or sophistry, but persuasion. Arguing from sound premises to a conclusion where you can get people on board, and to try and wrestle with differences of opinion by argument in the best possible way. So yes, I did spend a little bit of time thinking about GM, but then I moved, you know, quickly onto other areas within moral philosophy and applied ethics.
Mm. That's how certainly I see philosophy. I sort of see it as, you know, the old kind of Socrates sitting down with his mates having a chat. You know, they're very much dialogue, discussion about things, and as you say, persuasion. Are you a powerful persuader yourself, Doctor?
I have been known to be perhaps quite argumentative. It's something I'm working on, because you really also need to be creative and imaginative and empathetic. Mm. You know, I think I would advocate for emotional intelligence as well in one's encounters with anybody and everybody. And seeing the other person's point of view is essential, actually, to good reasoning.
Are you a good listener?
Again, it's something I like to think so, but I think the test is really one's interlocutor, I have to say.
But from your relationship experiences, have you ever been told that you're a good listener? I'd like to think.
I have, by close friends and clients. Well,
I think that's always a good sign.
Yeah.
I think that's always a good sign. And obviously, probably a key active ingredient to being a good philosopher. I mean, you know, if you're going to engage in, as you say, empathy and be an empath, it's got to be all about good listening, right? So you're able to listen, even if someone's opinion is heinous, you know, to be able to still kind of give it some respect by at least listening to it, even though you might wholly disagree with it.
100%. Yeah, and in fact, I mean, I'm a great advocate of going back to J.S. Mill. He was one of the best proponents of this in terms of a free speech advocate. The thing is around listening in situations where you may strongly disagree with somebody is not only, according to Mill, that there may be a kernel of truth in what the person you're opposed to is saying, but you're better able to identify that and make use of it if you listen and engage and contest ideas, instead of a lazy approach of speaking only to people who agree with you. So I've always been a great fan of listening to people I disagree with. In fact, I actively seek them out.
Okay, which is interesting, because I think one thing about social media now, when I look at my young kids and stuff and how they engage in the world, is they're not really engaging with people who think differently to them. They're engaging with people who think the same as them. And that's where they're pushed down, basically, the various different algorithms and rabbit holes in that social media environment. They're not engaging in the conversations that you're talking about. And in fact, when they meet somebody, perhaps by chance, that's different to them, they just cancel them. There isn't a conversation. There's just cancelling going on. Everybody's sort of deleting each other as opposed to kind of engaging with each other. Do you recognise that? I'm sure you do. You recognise
that?
Well,
yes, unfortunately, I think that's very much afflicted our society. It's a refusal to move beyond one's comfort zone, if you like, where that comfort zone is defined as those people who are reinforcing and playing back one's opinion. I think that's an extremely unhealthy state of affairs in terms of developing independent critical thinking.
You mentioned politics, and I don't want to get political, and I'm going to move on. I'm going to move on. But I'm just interested in what you think of the sort of the Trump thing that's happening in America. I mean, obviously it's been happening for some time, but how somebody at that level of such a zero empath, such a, you know, probably a narcissist, but, you know, somebody who just doesn't listen to anybody else, how somebody can be successful. Did you find that extraordinary?
Well, again, so I might even challenge, although I'm no great fan of Trump, your premises. I don't agree that he isn't capable of empathy. Okay. We may not like the way that displays itself.
Mm-hmm.
When he was last president and people were clamoring not to let him into this country, including the then or current mayor of London still, I was advocating to let him into the country so that he could go on, if you like, sensitivity training, maybe and visit mosques and engage with Muslims. So I actually happen to think that some of the things that make him quite popular, you could say he's populist, and that's the wrong kind of politics. But the thing is that I think he is a good listener, actually. Certainly to those to whom, you know, he appeals, okay, but there's a larger set of people. He's very flawed. I think people can identify with flawed, imperfect politicians in a way that they can't with the shiny veneer politician. They can't identify with that because they don't trust that person. Mm. They're more likely to trust somebody who's imperfect, flawed, and arguably hopeless in many respects.
They
like that person.
Yeah.
I don't know how he might realize this at some level. In fact, I also think he's quite smart. Mm. I'm not saying you're saying contrary to that, but I do think he's quite smart. He is at bottom quite a good political communicator. Mm. The day and finally, just while we're on it, I mean, you know, he survived an assassination attempt. Now, whatever you think of him, the way that he exploited that was quite extraordinary. Mm. Okay, he showed defiance.
Fight, fight, fight. Yeah. Extraordinary. Okay. Bloomsbury Festival. How have you connected with the team behind the Bloomsbury Festival? Is this your first time doing Bloomsbury Festival?
We've had a bit of a break, but yeah, we've enjoyed the London School of Philosophy. That is, we set ourselves up in 2010 in Bloomsbury, and you know, we quickly engaged with the Bloomsbury Festival, and we loved it because from our point of view, it aligned with the best of what we wanted within the London School of Philosophy, which is that we want to reach out, offer philosophy to a wider audience. And the Bloomsbury Festival is nothing if not that. Mm-hmm. And it's open, it's free in the case of our event. Mm-hmm. And so we're coming back after a couple of years. And the theme, I know they're often very broad and allow for plenty of interpretation, certainly lent itself to philosophical inspection or interpretation.
Well, because we've got a philosopher in the room, I'm going to ask you the question. So the theme, as our listeners will know, is human dot kindness.
Yes. Right?
So when you saw that, did the dot do anything? Did the dot, I mean...
Yes. So yeah. So I was in discussion when we were preparing sort of our bid for this with my colleagues. And it's a bifurcation, isn't it? The word humankind is being split there. Mm-hmm. And Jane O'Grady, who's one of those who'll be at the event, is going to have a look at that, actually. And she'll be talking about, I don't want to give too much away, but she'll be talking about differences between humankind and kindness, okay? And playing on the word kind. So, yes, it does. I mean, there's an area, a branch of philosophy, philosophy of language. And you could even have a talk around what that syntactically connotes, if you like. What just doing that with our language ends up doing to that piece of language. But yeah, in my own case, I think the theme that we've provided for our talk is philosophy with compassion.
Yeah.
By my lights, the whole purpose, or at least one primary objective of philosophy, is the pursuit of truth. Some might say it's the love of truth or wisdom. And some of those deep, perennial questions which still remain unanswered around what is the good life? How do I live the good life? Mm. I want to take a look at that through this lens of kindness or compassion, if you like. And the idea in a nutshell is this. We still have a tendency to torment ourselves, I think, if you think about relationships. What does it take to be kind? Do you have to be, as common parlance might go, cruel to be kind? Mm-hmm. It's particularly relevant in the case of parents bringing up children. Mm. You might say, well, they don't have sufficient intellectual capacity if they're very young to decide what's in their interest, but they also may need schooling, direction, guidance at a particular age as is appropriate for their age. And you might say that's paternalistic. You might say that stopping them from doing something, a child, for example, that's causing them anguish, is in their interest. So you can see the idea there of being cruel to be kind. But even as adults, you know, relationships break down. Former partners might argue around the morality or immorality of betrayal or cheating. So I'm interested in particular, this idea that does the interest, well-being of a human individual lie in them aligning themselves with the truth or their best effort at identifying the facts, if you like, of their situation? And how does a refusal or unpreparedness, if you like, for a person to align themselves with the truth, even to the extent that they might say, for example, to their partner, I don't want to know. Don't tell me if it's going to hurt me. Yeah. Yes.
Ignorance is bliss.
Quite. Are they actually doing the best by their own lives? And then we can say something around the good life. Does happiness, does what constitutes the good life consist of knowing the truth, even though it might hurt you? Or rather, is the good life, which is a more subjectively psychological conception, consist of mental states, if you like? I.e., you can only really be happy if you feel happy.
Yeah, no. Sorry, you stumped me only on the basis of what you were saying. You got me thinking so much that I kind of drew me into a lovely calm silence. Fantastic. So I've rocked up at the event. Okay, I've taken my seat. What am I going to experience? It'll be a series of talks. How many of you are there going to be attending? Yep.
Three of us are going to be presenting. We're just going to keep it short, like 10-minute bite-sized chunks. We've got, I think, an hour. Mm-hmm. So that would take us to half an hour, and then we'll have room for discussion. Brilliant. So Keith Barrett and Jane O'Grady and myself.
Okay, lovely. So this event is Philosophy with Compassion, London School of Philosophy. It's at City Lit Cultureplex on Saturday the 19th of October. It's at 1:30 p.m. And the best news is it's free. All you got to do is turn up, which is fabulous. And it's fabulous. There are a number of events actually at Bloomsbury Festival that are free, and it's fantastic. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for bringing philosophy to the airwaves. Some really interesting discussion. And have the best rest of your day. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.